Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. Scrounging is the art of looking for supplies in improbable places, in junkyards, in the trash blown about by hurricane-force winds during the pole shift, in cars that can no longer run on gas that is no longer available, on roads that have been heaved and buckled into disuse during the pole shift. I went scrounging for examples in the Trouble Times pages and found many examples, which I'm going to share with you this hour. So if scrounging is an art, can the skills be acquired? I quote from a description by Mike, a longtime Trouble Times solution set contributor. And I quote, "Scrounging is the ability to determine a need and to spot use locally items that will produce the intended functional result. It helps to first understand the problem or how the intended result should work. Let's take an example. It's after the pole shift and you need to move some valuable items, a bit too heavy to carry, through mud and slush to higher ground. The problem could be defined as how I can build a simple, lightweight pull cart that will work in mud out of the available junk found in the local environment. You recall that most mud vehicles have wide-base tires. So with the idea of wide-base tires in mind, you start your scrounging, looking around. You happen to find 4 empty 5-gallon cans, plastic or metal, it doesn't matter. And this gives you an idea. You could make wheels out of these by cutting a hole in the center of the lid and the bottom with your knife. Now you need an axle. You keep looking and find an old broomstick and a section of rebar. One will be used for the front axle and the other for the back. You find a couple of short wood boards that you put between and on top of the axles. You find some old electric wire that you use to hold the boards to the axles. You find a short section of PVC pipe and put a wire through this and back to the cart as a pull handle so it won't cut into your hands." End of the quote. So we're waiting until after the pole shift to do all this junk collecting, right? Else we're considered eccentric at best, and probably messy. Well, it's all in the salesmanship. As Mike says, "Once one gets good at this, one finds oneself collecting all kinds of things that others might think are totally useless. This can be frustrating to those significant others who think it's just junk. To you, it has many valuable future uses. After the pole shift, there will be no corner stores to get all you need. Scrounging will be your corner store. The bigger the junk pile you have to choose from, the more possibility of success." End of the quote. And Keith, another Trouble Times contributor, reports success even in the present day. And I quote, "My spouse would get upset at the junk I brought home. From the junk came my still. A methane digester, parts to build a semi-portable battery charger, a tiller motor, and a car alternator. Now the scrounging is netting me parts for a small windmill. I also pick up stuff to make chicken and rabbit hutches. The cost in all of this? Time. When the power was out for 4 days, the battery bank supplied power to the freezer and some lights, with an inverter that was made from more junk. The old adage is, one man's trash is another man's treasure." End of the quote. Let's step through the Troubled Times pages and see how many examples of scrounging we can find. For instance, making a slingshot in a pinch. One of these items where a stone is at the end of a rope, swung round the head, and then released in the direction of dinner. Or to rephrase, what can someone make out of old shoes and shoelaces? One gentleman's tale posted on the Usenets, and I quote, when we were kids, we made slingshot pouches out of leather, invariably cast off shoe leather and hence a bit stiff. We cut two slits in them about one half of the distance between the center of the pouch and the attachment points for the rubbers. This made the pouch fit more closely around the rocks or marbles we used for ammunition. Sometimes we connected the two slits with a third slit, creating an H-shaped slit in the middle of the pouch to allow a rock, especially an irregular pebble, to settle in even deeper into the pouch. The slit pouches on traditional slings undoubtedly are meant to do the same thing, contain a missile snugly and securely until the instant of release. You could even gauge the size of the missile the slingmaker customarily used by measuring the gap in the pouch. End of the quote. And from another, on construction of a slingshot, and I quote, when I was a wee lad, my dad made a sling for me. The pouch was from leather. The strings were woven cord. The pouch was elliptical in shape with a 4.5-inch major axis and about 2.5 inches on minor axis. A small hole about the size of a dime or nickel was cut in the center of the pouch. The length of the strings were the length of my arm, a loop for the middle finger and a large knot that was held between the thumb and index. As I recall, the hole helped hold rocks in place and made it a little easier to load. Must have been something he learned as a kid. Well, he was born way back in 1897. End of the quote. Or making a trawl in a pinch to collect crayfish, or yabbies as they are called in Australia. Down there in the mud, just wagging their feelers at you, but can you catch them? Per Jan in Australia, you can if you scrounge for a bit of junk, like chicken wire and rope. And I quote, in Australia, we don't use bait when fishing for freshwater crayfish, or yabbies, as we call them. We trawl for them. To make a basket to trawl them, you just need to shape chicken wire into an open basket and strengthen the top with heavy-duty fencing wire in a rectangular shape to stop it from collapsing while dragging it. Attach two ropes to corners like crossover handles. Then attach a long rope to the center of the handles, and it's finished. Throw the basket out into the pond and wait a while, then start pulling the basket slowly over the bottom towards you. The basket picks up the yabbies out of the mud. End of the quote. Needing a bow and arrow and not having a long, sturdy piece of wood that will do? After all, the ability to flex, while not breaking, is inherent in a good bow. Per Brian, if one has smaller pieces of wood or several canes, this can be accomplished. And I quote, quickie bows can be constructed in less than 5 minutes from a variety of materials and can have the added advantage of being a takedown, taken apart for easy transport. Just take two branches whose cut dimensions are about 40 inches long, 1/2 inch in diameter at one end, and 1/8 inch or so at the other end. Taper the wider ends and lash the limbs together, overlapping the tapered faces, to thicken the handle. Straight, knotless branches yield safer, more efficient limbs. Steeply tapered branches will permit 59-inch to 70-inch bows and effective length range. Another alternative is a simple garden cane or bamboo. With bundles of these, you can raise the draw weight by increasing the number by using more cane mid-bow, fewer canes toward the tip. Unlike a normal bow, each cane is strained independently. Strain on a single cane is the same whether bent alone or incorporated in a multi-cane bundle. A good effective bow can be constructed from 4 1/2-inch diameter bamboo garden supply beam poles. Wrap every 5 inches. At 28 inches, this bow will draw a staggering 58 pounds and cost practically nothing to make. This information is from the book The Traditional Bowers Bible. End of the quote from Brian. Desperate for distilled drinking water? Scrounge about for a bowl and some clear plastic and voila! Per a Usenet article, from the heat of the sun, you can even turn salt water, seawater, into potable water. And I quote, "The simplest systems feature a closed area with seawater in it. The top is made from clear plastic. The sun shines in and causes fresh water to evaporate off the seawater. Since the air inside the still is now warmer than the surrounding air, the fresh water vapor will condense on the sides of the apparatus. These parts of the apparatus are designed to let the condensate run down into a separate holding area for collection and consumption." This sounds complicated, but it can be fashioned simply. Suppose you find yourself washed up on an island without a fresh water supply. Simply dig a hole in the beach until you reach wet sand, but not actually waterlogged, as that will cause your hole to collapse. Put a bowl in the center of the pit. Cover with clear plastic. Seal the edges with more sand and place a small weight in the center of the plastic right over the bowl. You'll get fresh water as long as there's daylight. Keep the system set up overnight, though, as it's also a great rain catcher. End of the quote. With a couple of pots and pans, a highly efficient distiller can be made. This one requires a fire, however. Mike of Troubled Times made this from a schema he found on the internet and tried it out. He sent me the rig and even mechanically challenged Nancy could see how this works, instantly. There are two pots, one larger than the other. The smaller one has a lid. The bottom pot sits on the fire, the water in this boiling away to become steam to be condensed into distilled water. Then there's a pie tin and the lid of the bottom pot fixed together. By removing the handle of the lid of the bottom pot and making a hole in the center of the pie pan and bolting these together or welding them together, you hammer the pie pin a bit to fit the pot lid so that it's raised in the center of the pie pan like the lid is raised in the center, but the edges drop down a bit so that when the water collects, it rolls down into the outer side of the pie pan. Poke a hole in the side of the pie tin for the water to drain out, and you might weld like a copper tube into that hole so that you can collect it at the side into a jar or glass or bottle. Now you put the larger pot on top of this pie tin, filled with cold water to cool the distillate as it rises from the bottom pot through the hole. It will condense in the pie tin, hitting the bottom of the top pot, which has cold water into it, condense and drip down into the pie tin, roll to the sides of the pie tin, and find its way out that tube that you put in the side of the pie tin. Mike explains, and I quote, "When in operation, depending on the heat source, it produces a glass of water every 10 minutes. Designed for batch production, the water in the top and bottom pots will need to be changed approximately every 40 minutes. This time would depend on the amount of heat supplied to the bottom boiler pot. The water in the top cooling pot increases about 30 degrees Fahrenheit for each 10 minutes, and after 40 minutes is up to about 180 degrees Fahrenheit. One should end off when steam starts to come out around the bottom of the top pot. This occurs around or above 180 degrees Fahrenheit. At end of the cycle, after about 40 minutes, if one uses some of the top water from the top to replace and refill the bottom pot, then one can get back into operation in minimal time. At this rate, one could produce a gallon on the average of every 2.5 hours. End of the quote. Not only do you get a gallon of drinking water, You get a top pot full of warm water for washing. What if the issue is a sudden shelter need? You're out in the woods, no tent, and darn if it isn't starting to rain again. Per John, you can easily make a teepee from what you find in the woods, and I quote, 12 long pieces of wood of similar thickness and length make a teepee. The length of the wood determines the diameter of the teepee. It can be tied together at the top with rope, or strong vines, depending on availability. The outer casing is historically animal skin sewed together, but could easily be a tarp, the thicker the better. It naturally will give you a hole at the top for allowing smoke to escape the teepee. End of the quote. Well, what if you don't have a tarp or animal skins? Thatching, gathered in the woods, can work just as well if the footing of the poles are well secured. And per Ron, the American Indians had an ingenious way of making a temporary shelter, and I quote, a good Indian trick for temporary shelter is to find a cluster of saplings and bend them over and tie them to each other without cutting them down. They're already anchored down and after being bent can be thatched to provide a reasonable cover. When you leave, just remove the rope you used to tie them up and everything is restored to its original natural state. End of the quote. When the fuel for powering ocean-going vessels runs out, shipping containers will be considered junk. But are they? Sturdy and with doors that close firmly, they'd make ideal temporary homes. Clipper expounds on the idea he presented to the Troubled Times group. Connex containers are the 20-foot and 40-foot steel shipping containers used by the shipping industry to send goods over the seven seas. The manufacturer puts his goods in these and puts them on the backs of semi-trucks to go to the ocean liners where they take them off by crane and put them on the ship. After they get to their destination, they take them off by crane and put them on other semi-trucks where they're taken to the wholesale outlets. These shipping containers are sold as used in many places, such as shipyards. We can buy one locally for about $2,000. End of the quote. Speaking of housing, what about building a houseboat? After the pole shift, sea level will be rapidly on the rise, inundating coastlines and land and pushing inland. Some people will find themselves on virtual islands as the water gradually surrounds the land they are perched on. This island will get smaller and smaller, with land on the other side of the new inland bays disappearing from sight. What to do? Build a houseboat and anchor along the new inland coastlines, leaving your island behind. As I stated on the Troubled Times pages, and I quote, houseboats are in use in one form or another all over the world, particularly in cultures that rely upon fishing or where land is scarce. In an era when the melting poles will be forcing pole shift survivors back from the coasts, increasingly creating new inland bays, having a floating home that can be moved along with the new shoreline is practical. End of the quote. Houseboats normally have either flotation under them, as in sealed, air-filled metal tubes, or are built of materials that would normally float, as wood, like a raft, or operate by displacement, by displacing water as the boat sinks down. In this regard, a houseboat built on a concrete slab with raised edges can float. But I think that would make me nervous, as what happens when the houseboat meets some large waves and gets swamped? Down it would go. So how would scrounging help one build a houseboat? Plastic bottles, not yet recycled, filled with air and held under the boat by a net or chicken wire, as Keith explains. And I quote, I like plastic 20-ounce bottles, water storage, fishing floats, fishing net floats, storing small parts. Even in shelter construction use, they can be filled with water in the south wall for capturing solar heat, and make windows with them. End of the quote. Ah, yes, all those plastic bottles we just recycle. After the pole shift, the recycling centers, garbage, all the bottles in the grocery stores that you're going to grab and empty, don't throw those bottles away. They have many uses. Apparently, water-soaked wood becomes watertight, and this can work both ways. When making a wood barrel to hold water or wine or vinegar or whatever, one allows the wood to become water-soaked, thus sealed. Steve describes a Shaker community where this art can be seen in action. And I quote, "You ever find yourself in the Lexington area of Kentucky, Interstate 64, check out the Pleasant Hill Shakertown Village, though there are many Shaker villages in Kentucky. The restored Shaker religious community has live exhibits of people making barrels and furniture, spinning yarn, and broom making, to name a few. During the 1800s, it was a thriving religious community that was self-sufficient and sold many goods that it made around the country. The barrel making was particularly interesting, as well as the tools they used." End of the quote. And Kentucky is not the only such site, per Ivy, who reports, "Doing this type of trade is called coopering. You might inquire at Williamsburg, Virginia. They do this as a show for the old village." End of the quote. And Jan describes the technique, and I quote, "I have watched a cooper at work when we visited a tourist village called Old Sydneytown. The craft of cooperage is a highly skilled craft. The wood they use for the staves is air-dried for at least 1 year and then kiln-dried for around 3 weeks. The staves are then shaped with a long curved blade with handles at each end. When the staves have been shaped, narrow top and bottom, wider in the middle, and the edges beveled to fit together in a ring, the staves are fitted into a metal hoop where the temporary hoop is placed further up the staves. The barrel is then steamed in a steam tunnel to soften for final shaping. The barrel is then dried in a kiln." This course is an overview and does not address the complexities of the craft. They are not coated with anything, as a liquid they will hold swells the wood and makes them waterproof. There are other barrels made called loose casks for storing dry goods which are not waterproofed. End of the quote. So, got pieces of wood laying around, strips of metal that can be formed into hoops? Hey, make wooden barrels. But what if you're in an area that has clay soil, lacking housing, lacking wood, and you're thinking nostalgically about the adobe villages that Indians in the Southwest constructed? Can you get there by scrounging? Got any of those milk cartons, the 1/2-gallon waxed paper kind? The kind that are considered garbage? From the Troubled Times pages on the recipe for adobe bricks, and I quote, "The consistency of the brick mixture should be halfway between pancake batter and stiff cookie dough. The recipe for 6 adobe bricks. Time required about 1 month, most of it waiting for the bricks to dry. Cost, little or nothing. Materials, 1 5-gallon bucket, 1 mixing stick or old wooden spoon, 1/2 bucket of adobe clay, 1/4 bucket of sand, 1/8 bucket of straw cut into 2 to 3 inch pieces. Enough water to make a dough-like consistency. 6 empty 1/2-gallon waxed milk containers. Waterproof tape. Directions. Thoroughly mix the adobe clay, sand, and straw in the bucket, and add only enough water to create a workable consistency. You can use the waxed 1/2-gallon milk cartons. Cut one side from the carton, which becomes the open top of the brick mold. Cut and flatten the folded spout and tape the carton end firmly into a rectangular shape. Pack the brick mixture into the cartons, filling each about 2/3 full. In 15 minutes to 24 hours, the brick will be firm enough to tip out. Each batch is different. You'll have to judge when your mix will maintain a brick shape. Place shaped bricks in a sunny location and turn repeatedly as they dry. A completely dry brick is uniform in color, inside and out. End of the quote. Well, let's say you do have wood, but you lack woodworking tools. The best place to scrounge for manual hand tools after the pole shift might be old homes or old farms, where they often get tossed into the corner of a barn or near an old workbench or in the basement. But in the meantime, if you're looking for those tools, Clipper has some advice. And I quote, "I might add that pawn shops and yard sales are an excellent place to find these kinds of tools. I guess those that sell or pawn their tools get rid of what they consider useless ones first. I saw lots of hand tools just the other day at a local pawn shop." End of the quote. Per Ron, estate sales are another good source. And I quote, "Another place to find a treasure trove of the late 1800s hand tools for wood and metalworking is estate auctions. My ex-mother-in-law decorates her house with this sort of thing. We once went to one of those auctions and brought back a couple hundred pounds of excellent and hard-to-find woodworking tools. They were all just thrown into a few boxes. She spent about $25 for all of them." End of the quote. And per Eric, garage sales, and I quote, "The papers usually have garage sales which list tools as their item. One can collect quite a group of these if one frequents these sales and looks in the paper beforehand." End of the quote. And if, despite everything, you are missing certain tools, don't despair. You can smelt them. And I quote, "I built my forge out of a truck brake drum, a 55-gallon drum, some 2x4s, and some plumbing fittings. I scavenged a wood vacuum cleaner out of the garbage, and that still worked, and the plumbing fittings I had to buy. While power would be hard to come by after the pole shift, hand crank blowers and other ways to move the air over the fuel works. I use propane because it's easier on the neighbors, but low sulfur coal is really good to get that deep down, burn the metal heat. My first forge was more like a coal-fired jet engine because we didn't have a good way to control the air blast. I met a woman this summer who smelts her own iron. She takes iron rust and turns it into metal. Really neat, but very, very expensive in fuel and in the work it takes to refine the bloom of metal into something you can really use for anything. The tech is very low, clay and straw for the smelter, charcoal to fire it, and an air blast. The trick is getting it all to work correctly because the air blast has to be just right so there's not too much air in the furnace." End of the quote. A vacuum cleaner working in reverse is the air blower. And I've also heard that a hairdryer works well. But if one does not have electricity, the old-fashioned method of a leather hand-work squeeze worked back then and will work in the future. Speaking of electricity, can wind and water power be acquired out of scrounged materials? Listen to some of the inventive ways windmills have been constructed. This from Darrell. And I quote, "I was born in 1946 in East South Dakota, and the farm area there was quite late getting hooked up to the power lines. About 1960, my dad's farm was the last and furthermost customer north of the power co-op. We survived using kerosene lamps for light and a windmill water pump to water livestock. We had a 6-volt tube-type radio and charged the battery for a while with a homemade wind charger that my dad made with the top of a Model T Ford engine block. The Model T Ford engine was junk because of a broken crankshaft. It had a camshaft with a large gear in the front of the engine driving a 6-volt generator from the engine. Dad just bolted a prop to the large gear with 2 bolts. No pistons or pan oil or other moving parts. He climbed up there and oiled the moving parts regularly with an oil can. Today's engines are a lot different. You might be able to do something similar with a lawnmower engine. I understand a lot of them have been junked. Some of them, 8 to 10 horsepower, use a generator starter combo to start the engine and charge the battery after it's running. End of the quote. Car parts to augment a windmill? Of course, what Darrell was describing was the part of the windmill that would convert the turning motion into electricity. And for that, one needs an alternator or generator. Something with a permanent magnet in it, so that the turning action incites the movement of electrons in the wires around the permanent magnet. And these guys are just getting started. Here's a report from Jay. I just recently helped a gentleman put together a system. He had several novel ideas and used only hand tools, except for an electric saw and drill. He took the rear axle from a front-wheel drive 1982 Chevy Citation and cut it in half with a hacksaw. He said it was easy and only took a few minutes. He kept the emergency brake cables intact for later use. He then mounted one half of the axle to a length of thin wall tubing. I got this from a recycle center at about $6. Using 3 U-bolts made from all thread as his yaw bearing. Next, he made a rotating table out of scrap 5/8-inch particle board flooring material, scavenged with permission from a job site. He cut his table to a rectangle, reinforcing the underside at both ends and both sides with scrap angle iron scavenged from an old bed frame, also cut with a hacksaw and drilled for bolting to the table. When he got this far, he decided to call on me, as he drives by our place almost every day and sees our machines flopping around in the wind. He had read the Leger manual, so he had some sense of wind. He decided on 2 large-blade rotors for simplicity and reliability. His alternator was from a Volkswagen Jetta. Sprockets were removed from 2 27-inch, 10-speed rear bicycle wheels. Of course, they were a match. What he did was use a jack shaft. On the brake hub, he used 2 sprockets of 30 teeth attached by chain to a jack shaft with 2 of 10 teeth. Again, on the other end of the jack shaft, 2 sprockets of 36 teeth. Now, finally, on the alternator, 2 sprockets of 12 teeth. This is not an unusual configuration for a homemade wind generator. In each stage, there is a ratio of 3 to 1. 3 times 3 equals 9 to 1. A gear ratio 9 to 1 allows the machine greater ease in starting in low wind regimes. The reason that the sprockets were separated with washers was to make room for 2 chains, redundant reliability. This approach works very well, as less force against the bearings are required than if belts are used. End of the quote. Oof, a car axle, angle iron from a bed frame, particle board, hacksaw, board scraps, alternator from a VW, sprockets from a bike, washers and bolts, some chain. What next? This thing was made from scrap. Note the mention of the Leger manual, considered a must-have book on windmill building from scratch. And I quote, "The best place to research old plans is Popular Mechanics from 1900 to 1950. Reprints are available in paperback book form called The Boy Mechanic, Volumes 1, 2, and 3. Lindsay of Chicago also has the Leger manual for sale. Before you consider the construction of your own windmill devices, you should read that Leger manual published by Lindsay Publications. The cost of the manual is $8.95 plus $1.25 for shipping." End of the quote. An integral part of windmill operation is some means to convert the motion of electrons running down a wire. The permanent magnet with wire loops intrinsic in an alternator or generator, ideal for this conversion. Here we go again with car parts, and I quote, "I saw a water pump driving a generator about 15 years ago. I only drove past it a few times and noticed it. He was using a radiator fan belt for the wind blades. This may have been a truck fan belt and water pump. The fan was a symmetrical type, six blades, I think. End of the quote. Of course, windmills must have paddles to catch the wind, and here we go again. A radiator fan was mentioned earlier, but Darrell reports on handmade paddles made from wood. And I quote, "A lot of fan belts look like they would be off balance if used for power. I saw a wind propeller carved from a 2x4 board. Problem was the blade was a little off balance and made a whoop whoop sound like a helicopter. It was mounted on the roof of a house on a wood tower. He had to shut it off manually by turning it out of the wind and tying the prop with a rope. It worked really well for a while. Then the wind got really hard one day when it was running and the off-balance problem increased greatly, snapping the camshaft off. I saw many homemade windmills around those days, as everyone around there was in the same boat with power." End of the quote. So what does making a paddle involve? Per Darrell, if you're using a car axle to convert the turning of the paddles into turning a generator or alternator, you need big paddles. And I quote, 4-foot by 8-foot paddles might not develop enough torque to turn that car axle, drive shaft, and transmission. You may need paddles on the order of 8-foot by 16-foot to turn all of that. You can carve a propeller from a 2x4 like my dad did. Remember, the longer the prop, the more horsepower. It's really a rotating lever. 6 or 7 foot would be okay for what we're discussing. Keep the angle slight to start in slower wind. The leading edge will be rounded to the backside and tapered to the following edge like an airplane wing, which in effect each half resembles somewhat. End of the quote. And the cost of building a windmill from car parts? Remarkably cheap, even if you assume purchasing the car parts from a junkyard. Of course, post-pole shift, car parts will be just laying around asking to be used. And I quote, yes, it's true. You can build a very reliable and fairly efficient wind generator from used car parts. We do it quite often. For a reliable 1250-watt engine, modest but useful, using used auto parts, plan on spending from $150 to $250. That's bolts, nuts, belts, pulleys, bearings, generator or alternator, tower, just about everything. End of the quote. The Nebraska windmill is a mill that does not stand up on a tower to catch the wind, but's laid out on the ground, like the paddles of a water wheel on the back of a boat. The paddles are below ground for part of the time, in a hole dug in the ground. So air traveling along the surface of the land catches the paddles. It's easier to maintain, no climbing required. But if you have small children or animals about, best to put a fence around it. And I quote, I had a book no longer in print called Windmills of Nebraska, which was very good. Loaned it out and never got it back. It was a reprint of an 1880s manual put together by an agricultural agent who was fascinated by the ingenuity of the local farmers and their homemade windmills. In the 1950s, when I grew up, there were many working around the neighborhood. The Nebraska windmills, circa 1870, originated in the Middle Ages, centuries ago. They were used in castle towers for the purpose of pumping water. They had bucket pump type systems that was a continuous chain of buckets on a rope type belt that dipped into a well or cistern and on up to pour the water into a water tank run over wood pulleys. To shut down the windmill, you can apply a brake system to one of the axles, or enclose the windmill with doors that can be opened to allow wind through, or shut to stop the wind. They would be cheap and easy to build from scrap lumber with little imagination. The paddles could be as simple as 2x4 board frames covered with cloth like canvas, which would cut costs. I estimate about $200 to build it. End of the quote. Short on wood? For Darrell, canvas is an alternate for perils, like sails. And I quote, You can build it from canvas and run the sails at an angle instead of straight across, and it will look like a large screw shape. There are many variations of this design. End of the quote. The ability to shield a windmill from air turbulence is addressed by Darrell, who states that the Nebraska type, on the ground where turbulence is often greatest, can be shuttered. And I quote, "A few years back, I looked around to see what windmills were still working. I remember one that was up 80 feet and stood well above the farm buildings and trees, and the owner always had a hard time getting the help to climb up the steel tower and check the gearbox and add oil if needed. Sometimes it went long periods unchecked. It was still there then, working. It never blew over in storms. I wondered why. Now I know. Ground turbulence causes destructive forces. It's high enough to be above that. The Nebraska type is somewhat of a disadvantage there, since it usually is on the ground. But they were built on and in buildings at the top floors also, but of course at more expense. One much resembled a merry-go-round of the kind found in school playgrounds in the 1950s, the one where the kids kicked the ground to make it go round in a circle. The better versions built in buildings did have shutters or sliding doors with which to shut off the wind to protect the mill during storms, and a water tank above so the same building served as a water tower as well, so that water could be piped under pressure." End of the quote. Not in a position to take advantage of wind power? You can recharge your batteries with a bike gen. Scrounge for bike parts, especially bikes lacking inner tubes or tires, the part that wears out most often. Bike gens need the frame, the foot pedals, and humans pumping away on a bike frame suspended in the air. Don't toss those bike frames out. Scrounge for them. Set up human-powered bike generators. A Troubled Times member from Australia describes how efficient this can be. A 100-watt solar panel will probably only average 2 amps at best, even if it's rated 3 times or more higher, due to the sun angles, latitude, and cloud cover. Whereas a bike gen with alternator can output 30 to 50 amps or even more. The output depends on your strength and endurance. Output can be gotten at any time of day and in any location, a cave, a capsule, a survivor shelter, etc., irrespective of the sun, wind, or water. If we accept 12-volt DC as the standard, then focus from that for all other considerations. I cannot think of a cheaper way, a safer way, an easier way, a more flexible way, a more readily available way, or a more reliable way to generate electricity. I do have an exercise bike driving a car alternator, and it's a proven thing, too, able to bring a good charge to the batteries in the dead of night. End of the quote. Don't have a car alternator or generator, but have all those useless electric tools laying about? Mike states that the permanent magnet in an electric drill is just the thing for bike-genned electricity capture. And I quote, "If one takes out the variable speed trigger switch and uses a diode, one-way flow device in series with a permanent magnet motor, then we have a unit that can stay hooked up to a battery without acting like a motor. When one cranks, it charges the battery. This becomes a dedicated one-direction DC generator without the added loss of the small amount of resistance of the variable speed trigger switch." End of the quote. I must confess, I get a bit lost in all this technobabble electric speak, but I suspect you get the idea. There are photos aplenty available on the Troubled Times website to show what Mike is talking about, too. The Zetas highly recommend looking into a bike gen rig. And I quote from Zeta Talk, "Generating Electricity," written December 2002. "Modern man is much dependent upon electricity, though only having arrived there within the last 100 years or so. In primitive countries, communities work hard during the day, sleep at dusk, rise at dawn, and have little need of lights except for the occasional lamp or campfire. In pre-industrial days, this was likewise the mode, even the interiors of castles and palaces lit only by lamps, and then dimly. Modern man expects labor-saving devices, entertainment, communication with the world, and all at the press of a button. Modern man will have to do a mega mind shift after the shift if he thinks this will continue, as his life will be less than communities of centuries ago for the following reasons. 1. Where in the past, sunlight even on gloomy days could be anticipated, after the shift for most parts of the world, the light available will seem like going from dawn to dusk, skipping the midday entirely. 2. Oils and materials to burn for light will be scarce or water-soaked, what with continuous drizzle in much of the world, so fires will be a treasured occurrence from carefully dried materials. 3. Batteries and generators will wear out within months after continuous use by the desperate, with the shock of what has descended only coming late to these, not avoided. 4. Petrol fuels, or fuels from vegetation such as corn or wood gas, will run out without the means to pump, refine, or grow in the gloom. 5. The lack of parts for mechanical repair, lack of skills in those isolated, and lack of success with crops will doom all plans for fuels to be burned in the aftertime. 6. Skills to build generators collecting power from wind and water will be spotty, and the missing link theory applied endlessly, such that a single link, like a battery storage, dooms the plans. In light of all of this, what can mankind expect? Nancy has been practicing, walking about her house for months now, in the dark, such that she must grope to steady herself, and use touch, not sight, as a guide. Lights are used only when absolutely necessary. Practice this, and see how little you need light to walk through your day. Storytelling, group singing, eating and washing, enjoying the sounds and smell of the evening, none of this requires more than light enough to make out dim shapes. Those who are used to electric lights, and in groups where the lack of this has plunged the group into depression, have avenues to generate this. Exercise is one of the great depression lifters, and racks of old bicycles with the complainers pumping away is not only a means of generating lights during the session, it's group therapy. Group therapy thus becomes an exercise session where the 12-volt batteries are replenished. And perhaps the children would like to put on a play, practicing in the dark when they are put to bed and should be sleeping, whispered plans to surprise the adults. The bike gens can provide a floodlight for their stage. Thus it's not so much a loss as a challenge, an opportunity to be resourceful, as all of life is. End of the quote from Zetatop. Daryl laments about moving parts wearing out, gear oil, and the like. What about the oil replacement? You can scavenge around and find oil cans, drain cars, but what to do when scrounging no longer produces results? Per Gus, citing an article, canola oil is a perfect substitute. And I quote, imagine a motor oil that cuts automotive pollution by 40%. Dwayne Johnson developed a lubricant made from canola oil, a seed crop grown in Colorado. The canola-based lubricant drastically reduces automotive engine emissions compared to emissions from traditional motor oils. Canola oil is traditionally used as a cooking oil, especially in Asian foods. However, with processing adjustments, it's as effective an engine lubricant as any traditional motor oil. For those at a site where water is rushing down hills, moving water, a water wheel can be constructed. These can produce electricity in the same manner as windmills, but the ram pump fills your water tank from low ground to high ground where you want it for proper water pressure, like a silent robot that never rests. No electricity involved. All you have to do is scrounge for some pipes and a piece of an old and now useless inner tube from a bike. And I quote from the website, How Stuff Works. Ram pumps have been around for many decades and are popular for two main reasons. They need no external source of power. The force of moving water gives them the power they need. They're extremely simple with just two moving parts. The basic idea behind a ram pump is real simple. The pump uses the momentum of a relatively large amount of moving water to pump a relatively small amount of water uphill. To use a ram pump, you must have a source of water situated above the pump. For example, you must have a pond on a hillside so that you can locate the pump below the pond. You run a pipe from the pond to the pump. The pump has a valve that allows water to flow through this pipe and build up speed. Once the water reaches its maximum speed, this valve slams shut. As it slams shut, the flowing water develops a great deal of pressure in the pump because of its inertia. The pressure force opens a second valve. High pressure water flows through the second valve to the delivery pipe, which usually has an air chamber to allow the delivery pipe to capture as much high pressure water as possible during the impulse. The pressure in the pump falls. The first valve reopens to allow water to flow and build up momentum again. The second valve closes. The cycle repeats. The delivery pipe can rise some distance above both the pump and the source of the water. For example, if the pump is 10 feet below the pond, the delivery pipe might be up 100 feet above the pump. You can see that the one big disadvantage of a ram pump is that it wastes a lot of water. Typically, only about 10% of the water it consumes actually makes it up the delivery pipe. The rest flows out of the pump as the water builds momentum. The idea of using the energy of flowing water has been around for a long time. End of the quote. Here's another instance where a diagram would be handy, a picture worth a thousand words. I found a website with such a diagram, Virtual Clemson. Beyond listing the plumbing parts needed, it describes the use of the inner tube for the air chamber. Plumbing parts needed are valves, T's, unions, nipples, check valves, bushings, couplings, and a pipe cock. Houses ripped to pieces in hurricane-force winds, with survivors using an outhouse instead of flush toilets, and the city water supplies long dead, will provide a lot of plumbing parts to be scrounged. And I quote from the Virtual Clemson site, "The bicycle or scooter tire inner tube is placed inside the pressure chamber as an air bladder to prevent water logging or air logging, and inflate the tube until it's spongy when squeezed, then insert it in the chamber. It should not be inflated very tightly, but have some give to it." End of the quote. Best of all, get your hands on the Complete Hydraulic Ram Manual by Tom Motes, listed at $14.95 plus postage. And in closing, if for no other reason, scrounge to have something to barter, as bartering will be the medium of exchange after the pole shift. And I quote from ZetaTalk, Barter System, written December 2001. And that one skill set can be considered a bartering item, one should examine their own skill set by the following exam. If you were in the midst of a wilderness alone, what steps would you take to survive? What's the first skill that you would need and not have? Whom do you know that you would wish about you in such circumstances? What is the skill that they possess that you perhaps could develop? Imagine a group in such a setting having arrived at a land dump, where various pieces of junk are about and could provide a mechanical device or shelter if utilized creatively and resourcefully. How could you go about creating a comfortable home for yourself and others in such a situation? If you are clueless on how to use junk to construct a home, recycle, and hook up, then perhaps you should work with a junk man in his yard and take lessons. End of the quote. That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.